Joyce Johnson won a National Book Critics Circle Award for her book Minor Characters, a Beat Memoir. The book was originally published in 1983. It chronicles Johnson's life as a member of the Beat generation and her relationship with Jack Kerouac. Joyce Johnson spoke to Anne Strainchamps about her Beat memories. Johnson started by reading an excerpt from Minor Characters about how she met Kerouac. It was 1957. The phone rang. Allen Ginsberg answered it and told Johnson that someone wanted to speak with her.
Hello, I'm Jack. Allen tells me you're very nice. Would you like to come down to Howard Johnson's on 8th Street? I'll be sitting at the counter. I have black hair and I'll be wearing a red and black check shirt. I'm standing in Elise's kitchen holding the phone Allen has just handed me. It's a Saturday night, shortly after New Year's. Sure, I say. I put on a lot of eyeshadow in my coat and take the subway downtown to Astor Place and begin walking westward, cross town, passing under the bridge between the two buildings of Wanamaker's department store and the eye of the giant illuminated clock. It's a dark, bitter January night with ice all over the pavement, so you have to be careful. But I'm flying along. It's an adventure as opposed to a misadventure, under which category so far I've had to put most of the risky occurrences in my life. The windows of Howard Johnson's are running with steam, so you can't see in. I push open the heavy glass door, and there is, sure enough, a black-haired man at the counter in a flannel lumberjack shirt, slightly the worse for wear. He looks up and stares at me hard with blue eyes, amazingly blue, and the skin of his face is so brown. He's the only person in Howard Johnson's in color. I feel a little scared as I walk up to him. Jack, I say. There's an empty stool next to his. I sit down on it, and he asks me whether I want anything. Just coffee. He's awfully quiet. We both lack conversation, but then we don't know each other, so what can we say? I'd like to tell him I read his book, if that wouldn't sound gauche, obvious, and uncool. When the coffee arrives, Jack looks glum. He can't pay for it. He has no money, none at all. That morning, he'd handed his last $10 to a cashier in a grocery store and received change for a $5. He's waiting for a check from a publisher, he says angrily. I say, look, that's all right. I have money. Do you want me to buy you something to eat? Yeah, he says, Frankfurters. I'll pay you back. I always pay people back, you know. I've never bought a man dinner before. It makes me feel very competent and womanly. He has Frankfurters, home fries, and baked beans with Heinz ketchup on them. I keep stealing looks at him because he's beautiful. You're not supposed to say a man is beautiful, but he is. He catches me at it and grins, then mugs it up, putting on one goofy face after another. A whole succession of old-time ridiculous movie comedian faces flashes before me, till I'm laughing too at the absurdity of this blind date Allen has arranged. The notion of Allen Ginsberg arranging blind dates will crack people up years later when they ask me how on earth I met Kerouac. As for what he saw in me that night, I'm not sure at all. A very young woman in a red coat, round-faced and blonde. An interesting young person, he wrote in Desolation Angels. A Jewess, elegant, middle-class, sad, and looking for something. She looked Polish as hell. Where am I in all those funny categories?
You began by paying for his meal, and there were an awful lot of years or times when you did act as a kind of caretaker for him, especially, I guess, maybe after On the Road came out.
When On the Road came out, it was very hard for him to deal with the sudden huge change in his life. Suddenly he was not only famous, he was notorious, and it happened to him literally overnight. It was a complete reversal. There was so much attention, it was scary. The fans were avid to know him, to make contact with him. There were a lot of critics attacking his work. Most of what he said to reporters got sort of twisted around. It was profoundly upsetting to him.
You have a very funny scene. In fact, I think it's literally the morning of the day that the big New York Times review of On the Road came out and a reporter shows up. I wonder if you remember that scene at all.
I do remember that scene. The Times review had come out just the night before, and we went back to my apartment. And in the morning, the phone started ringing, and Jack's publisher arrived with a reporter and a case of champagne. during the course of the interview, a lot of champagne was consumed because Jack, that was the way Jack could deal with meeting reporters and dealing with the public. He'd have to get drunk in order to do it. He was basically very shy. And the reporter was asking him all these questions that were sort of, I thought, very annoying questions. I was eavesdropping on the whole thing, you know. Do you think America is going to go beat? You know, what's going to happen to our young people? I mean, the reporter, like a lot of other people, thought that being beat was about a kind of juvenile delinquency for older people. And Jack very patiently tried to explain the meaning of beat, how really it was, but he had derived it from the word beatific. And, you know, it meant to Jack and his friends originally that you were sort of beaten down to the bedrock of consciousness, but looking up and out for more experience.
There was a kind of ecstasy to it. But the reporter wasn't getting this at all.
He wasn't getting this at all, and he was just like a lot of other reporters. And it wasn't very long after that that Herb Kane out on the West Coast came up with the term beatnik, and the whole idea got very debased. It was sort of became a kind of code word for a kind of crazy lifestyle that involved bongo drums and berets and sunglasses and, you know.
Suddenly, I think you write that, you know, couples in the suburbs were having beatnik parties with their friends.
That's right. That's right. Once in a flea market, I came across a, you know, a do-it-yourself beatnik kit. It contained a goatee, dark glasses, and a beret.
Oh. In the meantime, there you were, the woman in the background who was kind of holding Jack Kerouac together through all of these events. And, you know, as more and more people wanted a piece of him and as he began to kind of disintegrate, you know, there's scene after scene in which you're the one ending his appearances saying, Jack, we got to go. Jack, it's time to leave, you know, before he pretty much crumbles. Were you really the one sort of holding him together during some of that time?
I was trying to hold him together as best I could, but it was a pretty hard job. Just the prospect of getting him home and up four flights of stairs safely was kind of hair-raising.
Was it galling to you then? I imagine it must be some today to think, you know, here you were, the woman in the background, not seen as a talented writer in your own life. I mean, one of the big criticisms of the male beat writers today is that they were misogynistic. Would you say that was the case?
Well, you have to remember that I was so much younger than Jack, and I was just beginning to write. So I didn't have that feeling that people should be paying attention to me. I was struggling with my first novel. In fact, Jack used to tell me, you know, don't be like me, don't revise, first thought, best thought. But of course, I couldn't do that. So, you know, I revered him as an older, incredibly gifted and experienced writer. He was sort of a mentor of mine. I accepted that role. Also, you have to remember that the 1950s were a terribly misogynistic time. And in the arts, it was generally felt that women couldn't really produce anything important or worthwhile. It was just sort of an idea that was sort of spread through the culture. You know, when I went to Barnard College, which is a women's college, I was an English major. We studied only one female writer. That's unthinkable right now. Mm-hmm. So it was a very, very different scene for women. Jack, I have to say, in contrast to other men I met, took my writing very seriously and was very encouraging.
You know, he's still such an American icon. Looking back, what do you think is the biggest misconception people have about him?
I think people over the years have confused him with Dean Moriarty in On the Road, who was, you know, based on his friend Neil Cassady. And Jack was always quiet, withdrawn, reflective, very much an observer, even though he wrote in On the Road that he'd gotten the message, go moan for man. He wanted to moan for man only at the typewriter. I don't think he envisioned being a spokesperson for a generation. That wasn't what he wanted at all. He was also a weird kind of mystic. His beliefs were a combination of the Catholicism of his childhood and Buddhism.
So it's been 50 years since On the Road was published. And there's still an extraordinary amount of interest in the Beat movement, more so now because of the anniversary. But why do you think there's still so much interest in the Beat movement?
I think that the message of the Beats is still very potent, you know, the message of the Beats as opposed to the message of the Beatniks, that feeling of being open to experience, of not being materialistic, of trying to find out who you are. I mean, that's a very potent theme for young people, and I think it always will be.
Joyce Johnson is the author of Minor Characters, a Beat memoir. She spoke with Unstrange Shapes.
I'd rather be thin than famous. I don't want to be fat. And a woman throws me out of bed calling me Gordo. And every time I bend to pick up my suspenders from the Davenport floor, I explode loud, huge grunto and disgust everyone in the familio. I'd rather be thin than famous, but I'm fat. Paste that in your Broadway show.
Jack Kerouac with I'd Rather Be Thin Than Famous, chorus number 104 from his poem Mexico City Blues. Steve Allen accompanied Kerouac on piano.